could see.
You must take good care of Emily while I'm gone, Narcisse said.
You must take good care of Emily when you get back, Philomène answered. Narcisse moved toward Philomène, the craving look in his eyes. Will you talk to Madame? Philomène asked. He didn't answer. You won't forget? Philomène pushed.
I'll talk to Aureline before I leave, Narcisse said, removing his coat. You're a striking woman, Philomène. Take down your hair.
Philomène couldn't understand her staying power for Narcisse. She was 22, her skin coarse and darkened by the sun, angry red blisters her bonnet couldn't block at the back of her neck, her hands calloused. But he was still drawn to her. He still listened, guided by her glimpsings. She unwrapped the scarf from around her head and shook her hair free. Weeks after Narcisse finally rode away from Cane River to fight in a war over cotton and slavery, Philomène discovered she was pregnant. She had not known about the coming child in time to weave a protective glimpsing around it. The war came into Cane River's backyard in the spring of 1864. Food was scarce, but they had learned to make do on Oubre's farm despite dwindling supplies, the drought, boredom, isolation, and uncertainty. They counted totally on themselves, Aureline and Philomène and the children, growing their own food, hunting, foraging, and stretching what they still had, mostly corn, beans, and the remains of a side of bacon in the smokehouse. Corn, which in different times had been grown mostly to fatten hogs and feed slaves, had become the mainstay of everyone's diet. Philomène trapped what she could, and they sometimes had fresh meat, but not often. They had long since grown used to having no money, and even if they had, the price of everything was so high that they could have bought little anyway. With Narcisse no longer bringing either necessities or luxuries, and the Confederate soldiers who now occupied the valley appearing at random intervals on their doorstep to cart away corn or fodder as provisions for their units, the women hid the least replaceable of their foodstuffs. The troops drew most heavily from the plantations, but even the smallest farms were not immune. The single scrawny, spike-horned cow with the Oubre brand on its ear had disappeared before they'd had a chance to slaughter it for themselves. Foraging for nuts, fruits, and berries had become a competition among children, soldiers, runaways, deserters, and farmers. In the spring, the invading Union army pushed its way up from New Orleans through Natchitoches Parish, following the course of first the Red River and then the Cane River. It was the driest spring in 20 years, the river falling to barely 3 feet. The morning was gray, the air cold and smelling of smoke. Philomène and young Joseph had been pulling up spent corn stalks since daybreak to get them ready for burning, when 4 Confederate soldiers in ill-fitting, mismatched gray uniforms rode their horses onto the farm, heading straight for the house. Philomène wondered how much of their food would be taken this time. There was little enough to spare, and although her appetite hadn't increased as much as when she'd carried the twins or even Emily, cutting down on portions again would be difficult.
"Let's get to the house, Monsieur Joseph," Philomène said, throwing down the hoe. "Better they see all the mouths needing to be fed."
By the time she and young Joseph got close, Aureline was facing down the 4 men on the gallery.
"But how will we get back on our feet again?"
Philomène heard Aureline say to one of the soldiers as he set out in the direction of the barn. Aureline carried Emily in her arms, struggling to catch up to the soldiers. Josephine, Mina, Valériane, and Valérie followed close behind her, their faces full of fear by the panic in Aureline's voice.
"They're going to burn the cotton!"
Aureline blurted out to Philomène as soon as she caught sight of her. The 4th soldier lagged behind. He was a nervous boy whose pale eyes darted. He glanced at Philomène with suspicion and then said to Aureline apologetically,
"It might be best for you to stay here, ma'am.
We're burning all the cotton so the Yankees don't get it."
Philomène stayed behind Aureline and kept young Joseph close. She could see how young the soldier was, his eyes a mottled gray-blue that didn't fit his face.
"You're even younger than Florentine was when he left," Aureline said in wonder to the boy. "How old are you?"
12, ma'am."
Aureline glanced back to where Philomène stood with her arms draped over young Joseph's thin shoulders, his back leaning into the roundness of her belly. Aureline pulled her eyes away from her son and turned back to the young soldier.
"You mustn't burn our cotton," she said, trying to reason with the boy. "You're on our side."
"Those are our orders, ma'am. The Yankees have already been through here once on the way up to Mansfield on the Red River campaign. You were lucky they missed you. They're following the river, but they'll be back through this time for the cotton. We have to torch it."
"What about the barn?"
Philomène whispered to Aureline. Aureline, eyes grown dark, ran ahead to one of the older men, a coarse-looking soldier with both teeth missing in front. He appeared to be the leader.
"Wait!" she said. "What about the mule, the plow? You can't burn down our barn!"
"We have a job, and not much time. Anything you want from the barn that's not cotton, you better clear it out in the next few minutes."
"Will you help?" Aureline pleaded.
"I'm giving you time," the soldier said, wiping at his forehead. He stopped and took a long look at Aureline, hesitating. "I have a farm and a wife alone. Her hair's the same color as yours. We'll just take the chickens, not the mule or the hog. You better hurry."
Aureline ran back to where they all stood.
"We have to get everything we can out of the barn," she ordered,
hastily handing little Emilie off to Valerie.
"You two stay put. Everyone else to the barn. Hurry, hurry!"
Valerie started to hiccup, but the little boy stayed put, clutching Emilie so tightly that she started to cry. The rest followed Aureline. Inside the barn, Aureline grabbed Philomène's arm.
"What should be saved?"
"Get out the mule and plow and as much of the fodder as you can," Philomène said, "and the grain and seed stored in the corner. The children can carry the tools out. Make sure of the harness and reins and sacks. I'll get the hog away."
Philomène opened the gate and drove the hog with a peach tree switch as far from the barn as she could, the heavy porker grunting and squealing.
When she got back to the barn, Aureline was still struggling with the mule, which refused to budge.
"Madame, move the seeds," Philomène said. "I'll see to the mule."
Philomène pulled at the length of rope Aureline had fashioned around the mule's neck, but the animal brayed and sat on its hind quarters, determined not to move. She picked up a buggy whip and struck at the mule until her arms ached, and at last the beast got up onto all fours. Philomène ran around to the back of the mule and gave him a savage lash to get him moving. She never really saw his hind leg kick out, but suddenly she was down on the ground, the wind totally gone from her, a deep pain in her stomach. She looked up to see the mule bucking and braying, moving away from where she lay sprawled in the dirt, starting at last toward the sunshine. The farm was in turmoil, dust flying, sounds louder than she could bear. She picked herself up unsteadily amid the squealing, braying, and crowing. She heard Emily's cry, mixed with other shouting voices, and saw the young soldier with the gray-blue eyes helping young Joseph drag a bag of grain through the barn doors. She grabbed a harness and took it out to the growing pile outside the barn.
"No more time! Everybody clear out!" pronounced the soldier with the missing teeth.
He took a large can from his horse's saddle and splashed the bound bales of cotton with the liquid contents. Flames flashed upward as soon as he struck the match. It took some time for the fire to engulf the stacks of cotton, giving out a dark, suffocating, dense smoke. But then the flames grew bolder and more greedy, ripening until they were as high as the beams of the barn. When the Confederate soldiers were satisfied that the cotton was beyond reclaiming, they mounted their horses and rode away. Neither the boy with the gray-blue eyes nor the man with the missing front teeth looked back to where the women and children huddled together, watching the flames. Philomène took Emily from little Valerie and held on to her, in the same way that Aureline drew young Joseph close to stand next to her. It was all they could do, watch helplessly as the barn and everything inside burned, hoping the wind wouldn't shift and carry the sparks to the house, hen house, corn crib or smokehouse, or Philomène's cabin.
"What will Monsieur Valerie say when he comes back?" Aureline said.
Philomène watched the flames curl. Philomène lost the baby the next morning, her stomach cramped so hard in on itself that she couldn't get up. But she could stand again by the afternoon, and joined in with the salvaging of Oubre's farm. 4 babies, and only 1 safe, she thought. The barn still glowed in spots into the next night, and they went on as best they could, making a new sty for the hog, gathering the last 2 scattered chickens the soldiers had not caught, pulling the spent corn stalks, reburying the precious sack of salt behind the smokehouse. From their farm they could see the ribbons of flame fan out for miles as lifetimes went up in smoke. They ate plentifully for the next few weeks, less willing to hoard what they assumed would be confiscated by one army or the other coming through. For 2 days they heard volleys of gunfire, most of the time distant, but sometimes so close that they huddled inside the house together, terrified, and the sound of explosions came from the direction of the river. They cooked only during the day, when the smoke would not be as visible, their only defense their remoteness, their invisibility, and they didn't venture off the farm.
"If Yankees come, they'll burn whatever we have left," Aureline said.
Philomène thought of the moonlight chair in her cabin, the only thing she owned.
"Maybe they'll stick to the river," she said.
When gunfire became random and sporadic, young Joseph Ferrier ventured out alone one morning, beyond the closed-in island they had made of Oubre's farm. He did not return until late afternoon, dragging the carcass of a small shoat. His face was charred, and there was animal blood on his clothes. Aureline fell on the boy at once, hugging him and crying. Philomène began to butcher the pig as young Joseph told them how he had come into possession of it.
"I cut through the woods, hiding behind trees at any sound, and followed the line of the river," he said. "All the fence posts and ties within sight of the river were gone. There were several people moving about. When I came to Monsieur Tessier's plantation, it had been torched. Only the stone chimney was left. Tessier sat in the dirt, surrounded by charred lumps at his feet. I came closer and saw they were dead pigs. He told me to go back home, that it wasn't safe to be out, that there were still Yankee stragglers."
Aureline kept touching the boy, even as he talked.
"He had sent his family away up to Compte to stay with relations, and stayed behind to protect the place. The Yankees burned every plantation for 10 miles, from Rachal's to Monette's Ferry. At Tessier's, they slaughtered all the hogs, but they carried off only the fat ones and left the others to spoil. They even burned the chicken houses. They took the last ears of corn and the last pound of bacon. What they didn't carry or burn, they smashed or scattered. And then his Negroes stole his mules and followed off behind the Yankee troops. He told me there were 2 fights, one on the river and one on land. The explosions were from the Union boats trapped in the low tide. They must have run out of coal, and they were trapped until Union soldiers slipped ashore and stripped the land of all the fence posts, carrying the wood back as fuel. They fired up their boilers and got out. Monsieur Tessier told me to take one of the small pigs, and I dragged the rotting carcass the whole way. I heard Negroes singing from the other side of the river, some verses plain. 'When the Lincoln gunboats come' was one. 'The day of jubilation is near' was another."
The invasive smell of burned cotton choked the air, and the women and children on Ubro's farm went on day by day, salvaging, repairing, and surviving. The war was not over, but there was an inevitability that settled over the farm like a heavy fog. Even after several months, when the wind blew in a certain way, Philomène still breathed in the smoldering odor of flaming raw cotton. It smelled to her like freedom. Freedom for herself and for Emilie. Chapter 24. It was a confusing time after the war was officially over. Masters without slaves, and slaves without masters. Aureline Durban looked sour, the features of her face wavering between disbelief and anger.
How can you think to leave me now? After all I've done for you and your family. I looked after you more times than you could know, ever since you were a baby. I was the one who took you, Suzette, and Palmyre in together, against the best judgment of my first husband. Your life could have been very cruel indeed, if not for me.
Her unsheathed fury snaked across the room. Philomène shrugged, detached, momentarily distracted by the uncontrolled fluttering of Aureline's hands. They stood, facing one another, in the common room of Ubro's farmhouse, the same room where they had spent so many evenings banded together, getting their children through the war.
"You've never been whipped," Aureline persisted. "Balance the scales. Give us time to get past the ruin. It's not too much to ask that you stay here, instead of going off on your own just now. Stay to help with the land and the children. Not forever, but until Monsieur Ubre gets his health back and can work again."
Philomène had been free since spring, and most of the white men had made their way to Cane River by now. Narcisse had returned 3 months ago, long enough to give Emilie his last name, long enough to plant another baby. Already the days were getting shorter. It was August, and Philomène had stayed to strip the leaves from the corn stalks and lay them out to dry to use as animal fodder. It was the last of the field work she intended to do on Ubre's farm.
"Speak up, Philomène! Will you stay?"
"We've stayed longer than we had to," Philomène said calmly. "It's time for us to move on, madame. You never whipped me, true enough. If you had enough to eat, we had enough to eat. I can't complain about our clothes, same as that mule over there wouldn't complain about having to go without shoes. But these are freedom times now, and the account between us is closed and paid up in full." Philomène's belly would soon be large again, noticeable, and she was anxious for this confrontation to be over. She wanted to be settled in her new home before the baby made her movements more difficult.
"If it hadn't been for the wretched war," Aureline said, "I was prepared to see after you forever. Put food into your mouth and that of your children. Put clothes on your back, nurse you if you got sick the way I did when you got the yellow fever. I treated Emilie as if she were one of my own, and I was prepared to keep on taking care of you, even after you were too old to do for yourself. Are you saying that's not worth something?"
"We made the arrangement work, madame, and there's no need for harsh words now that things have changed." Aureline kept saying forever, Philomène thought. "She isn't asking us to stay forever. She would have done for us. Forever. The only forever for a slave was more work at someone else's bidding and an uncertain future left in others' hands.
My body will wear out soon enough, madame. I want to have something of my own before that happens. Something I can leave to my own children. The same way you want me to stay and do for you and your children and your farm. I've been taking care of you and yours my whole life. I have to put my own children in the first place now."
Philomène rested her hands on her belly, finished, and then decided to try once more, picking her words carefully.
I won't let freedom for Emily and me go to seed for lack of nurturing.
She thought of her unspoken bargain with Narcisse Frédieu, both all that she had lost and what she stood to gain.
My Emily will have a different kind of life from mine. I can't do that on this farm.
Just stay the year, Aurélie negotiated, and then you can go off on your own. That's what a lot of your people are doing. Just work out the year for a part of the crops.
It would have been easier to follow the path Philomène knew so many others had taken. Just pack up and leave without the weight of words or explanation. But she wanted the break to be civil and clean. The law declared her free, but the desperate woman standing in front of her was still white, and the need for caution was just as strong as it had always been.
I am sorry, madame. I do not have an extra year to spare, Philomène said. It is a late start for me already.
6 months, then. You owe me that.
And what do you owe me for selling my Clermont to Virginia?
The idea of freedom had made her so heady that the words were out before Philomène thought them through. Unmistakably accusing words that couldn't be recalled. It would have been an unforgivable exchange between slave and mistress. In these shifting times, they were disconcerting words between a freed woman and a landless farm wife. The previously unspoken took solid form and drew in breath of its own, putting the two women out of easy reach of one another.
"You ungrateful girl!" Aureline said, her face twisted and ugly. "Standing there talking to me that way, carrying another bastard child. Those were difficult times. I did what I had to in order to save us all."
Aurélien panted softly, as if her breath were being stolen away. The air was too thick with bared truth to go forward safely. Philomène drew back and reconsidered. There was nothing to gain by revisiting what could not be undone. Freedom or no freedom, there was everything to lose by setting up a back current of ill will from her former mistress. Philomène no longer hated Aurélien for selling Clément. That had become too heavy a beast to drag day after day, and she had deliberately forced herself to give up the hatred. She had long since shut out everything about Aurélien except for whether she was useful or not useful, and she had bided her time. It was the way of things that Narcisse could be more advantageous to her now, and this was the right moment to move on. Antagonizing Aurélien was foolhardy and counterproductive, and Philomène regretted pursuing that course.
Oui, madame. Forgive me. You are right. I overspoke.
She drew in her voice, making it soft and humble, conciliatory.
You've been a good mistress, to my mother and to me and to Emily. I am grateful. It's just that now is the time to go off and build up something for my own children. You are a mother. You must understand.
Your mother would never do such a thing, running off at the first opportunity.
I am not my mother, madame.
I see that now, Aurélien said. Go then. Leave me alone.
Philomène was glad to go. She never again wanted to work a farm on which she had no chance of earning a stake. She was aching to tackle fresh land. From the first news that the Yankees occupied New Orleans 3 long years before, she had played with the idea of staying on to work the land on Oubre's farm as a free person. The teasing specter of freedom sharpened with each whispered report of southern battles lost, and her dreams got bolder each passing year of the war. The more trampled and hopeless the southern cause became, the more she allowed herself to envision her own land, and the Oubre farm became a hope too small, outgrown. But Philomène was not one for idle dreams and wishful thinking. She had learned the hard lesson about land ownership from watching the chain of events after Ferrier died from yellow fever. You could be forced off land you didn't own, in the same way that if you didn't own yourself, you or yours could be sold at any moment, on someone else's whim. Neither Aurélien nor Valérie actually owned the land they were working for someone else, hoping for a good crop to split a small profit. If Philomen stayed with them, she was that much further from her goal. Freedom changed everything. Land was what burned at Philomen now, her own land. With Narcissa's sponsorship, if she worked hard enough, she could save to buy land herself. It was possible. She was sure this was the path for gathering her family back to where they belonged, together. Narcisse never answered her repeated requests for a piece of his own lands, ignoring her completely, or clearing his throat and bringing up the subject of long-term debts and back taxes, but he arranged for Philomen to work part of his neighbor's property. Narcisse agreed to move the cabin she had on Oubre's farm to its new location, at the southwest corner of Richard Grant's old plantation. Philomen didn't care that Grant wasn't French, wasn't considered quality. There were more ruined quality folks than could be counted in Natchitoches Parish these days. Philomen cared only that she was free, and her children would be free. She was going to be a sharecropper. Narcisse came back from the war changed. He wasn't a broken man, but he moved more slowly, as if some of the air had been let out. Many of the men who came back were already reliving the battles, full of talk and opinions on the war and the insulting absurdity of the new government. Narcisse refused to say anything about where he had been, what he had seen, and he seemed relieved that Philomen didn't probe. He was more content than ever to sit with Emily on his knee, letting his little daughter amuse him with her bright ways for hours at a time, playing in his beard, digging in his pockets, singing him her special made-up songs. There was little need to prod him in his duty to Emily. His daughter delighted him, and when he first returned he was incautious in his love for her, carrying her everywhere. Narcisse's wife, Asine, had died just before war's end. His mourning seemed genuine to Philomen, even though he had never been that fond of her while she lived, as if he were uncomfortable at the thought of being without a wife. Many of his friends and neighbors were crushed or ruined by the war, financially and emotionally, but Narcisse came back whole, gone only a year, and with the means to start over. Almost no one had managed to keep hold of their cotton along Cane River, but neither the Yankees nor the Confederates had uncovered the cotton stored on his wife's farm in Comté. When southern ports were thrown open, Narcisse recovered some of his wealth, at least enough to settle unpaid back taxes, debts, and interest. He held on to most of his lands, even as he allowed his world to narrow, letting things happen around him of their own accord, no longer hard-charging at life. He returned to Philomen's cabin with a new hunger, as if the thought had entered his mind for the first time that she didn't have to accept him there, and that Emily was his only flesh-and-blood legacy. Philomen, determined to be settled into a new life by the time of the new baby's coming, asked Suzette, Elizabeth, and her brother Jérôme to move in with her on Richard Grant's plantation, the first step in her plan to restore the family. It was to be the beginning of the realization of her true glimpsing. Elizabeth nodded, deciding immediately, eager for the chance to have her grandchildren and great-grandchildren around her. But Suzette was vague and noncommittal, no matter how hard Philomen pressed her. Jérôme agreed, willing to do any kind of labor himself. Jérôme had married, and as long as his wife Mélantine would not be expected to go to the field, he was eager to move on to the land. They put that behind them, he said, and they wouldn't go back. Philomen gambled with another false glimpsing, the first she had spun for Narcisse in more than a year. She found that his blind belief had gotten even stronger. "We'll have a son, a younger brother for Emily," she said to Narcisse, and he was as receptive as always, his desperate wanting blocking all else. She knew how to play the trick now. If the baby turned out to be a girl, she would say that the glimpsing must have been of a future son they would soon have. It would work out either way. "I see Emily and your son together, and he has the Frédieu look. Both he and Emily carry your name. The brother and sister play together in front of a house.
It isn't this house we have here. It's bigger. And there's a wide door leading inside. On our own land. Elizabeth and Jérôme are close by.
Narcisse stroked his dark beard down to its wavy point, considering. Every day Philomène prayed to herself.
Just get the child born. Let him grow up free and strong. And don't let him be taken away from me.
The responsibility for the new life inside her thrilled and terrified Philomène, her first child to be born free. She woke sometimes in the middle of the night, soaking in her own sweat, the details of her dreams scattered, recalling only vague uncertainties. What if Clément came back? Before freedom, she had never allowed herself to believe that she would ever see Clément again. Now he could come back to her with the same determination he had shown in the storm. She couldn't feel him alive, try as she might, and without Clément, Narcisse was her best bet for the life she envisioned. But what if she was wrong about Clément? What if he made his way to her? She had been living as if man-woman love were dead, substituting man-woman practicality, and she wasn't sure what would happen if Clément found her now, hard and used. What would he do? What would she do? How far had she bound herself to Narcisse Frédieu for the sake of her family and her children? What if her glimpsings couldn't protect this child, as they had protected Emily? What if Emily was all she was allowed? There were too many questions, and too few answers.
Chapter 25. Elizabeth sat alone on the front gallery with a wide-mouthed bowl squeezed tight between her knees, shelling peas. A figure approached in the distance, his gait slow but steady. When he turned off the wider dirt road toward the farmhouse Elizabeth shared with Philomène and her two children, she paid closer attention. He was a colored man of middle age, and too much exposure to the sun had given his light, honey-colored face the appearance of a golden-baked crust. His skin was pulled smooth and tight, most likely from hunger, Elizabeth supposed. One of the hordes of the displaced that flowed in or ebbed out like the tides since the war ended. As he came closer, something tugged at her about the purse of his lips, the set of his eyes. This one was a high yellow man with a wide mouth, dirty reddish-brown curls, and clothes that gave away that he was from somewhere else. That and the soft slanting of his words as he came up to stand before the gallery and address her.
"Good afternoon, madam," the stranger said. His French was halting and stiff, but he could be understood. "Is this Elizabeth's house?"
"This is my granddaughter's house."
"Curious," Elizabeth thought. "Slave Creole in words, but foreign in dress and manner.
You look like it's been a while since you rested.
Help yourself to a little water from the dipper."
"I've been on the move for some time. I appreciate it. Thank you, madam."
Elizabeth went back to her peas as he drank. She sized up this stranger asking about her. He seemed soft to her.
"You're not from around here," Elizabeth said. "Where you come from?"
"I'm from Virginia, madam."
"Have you eaten?"
"Not in quite a while, madam."
"Come on inside with me while I dish you up something. We have the leavings of the stew from supper."
Elizabeth rose stiffly and carried the half-full tin of peas with her. The man followed her into the dark house, through the front room and into the kitchen. Elizabeth waved him to sit at the pine table. She scraped out all that was left of the stew from the kettle into a wood bowl and handed him a spoon, and then she cut a quarter round of yesterday's cornbread. She poured him some buttermilk and lowered herself into the chair across from where he sat. He hunkered over the bowl like a ravenous dog, barely taking the time to chew the small bits of meat in the stew. Mostly it was vegetables blended beyond recognition in the long cooking. The man crumbled what was left of the cornbread into his buttermilk and drank it down in gulping swallows. Only when he was finished did he look up, embarrassed.
I'm sorry. Like I said, it's been some time since I last ate. That was very good.
Sorry there's not more.
The stranger seemed harmless enough, but he was fidgety, rubbing his fingers together nervously.
What are you doing looking for, Elizabeth?
No disrespect intended, but that's something best taken up with her. I mean her no harm. They say she came through the war all right and she lives here on this farm, but I might have gotten turned around on the road a little.
The man was trying to study her when he thought she wasn't looking.
Lots of women called Elizabeth in these parts. The Elizabeth I'm looking for comes from Virginia. She was sold away from there almost 50 years ago to a man called Pierre Darbin, and ended up on his son's place called Rosedew. She has a granddaughter, Philomene.
Elizabeth's old memories began to stir, and she looked carefully at the man's face for clues. She had liked the soft-spoken stranger who came out of nowhere, but now she was uneasy, unwilling to believe that she could make it all the way into her 60s, through slavery and freedom, and still feel the lurch of life shifting and becoming unsteady beneath her.
Who are you?
Again, no disrespect, but I've already been to Natchitoches, Cloutierville, Isle Breville, and Monette's Ferry tracking this farm down.
Please.
Is it you?
I'm Elizabeth.
What do you have to do with me? You left Virginia nigh on 50 years ago, from Lost Oak Plantation?
Yes, that's me. What's your business?
You had 2 sons, John and Jacob?
Elizabeth's throat seemed to dry up, sealing off the escape of her words. The longer she took to respond, the more uncertain the man became, until he looked like a frightened little boy forced to drop his pants as he waited for a whipping.
You better tell me what you came to tell me, stirring up old sadness like yesterday's soup.
The man spoke quickly then, but he tripped over his words as if his courage had wound down.
They call me Yellow John. I think I'm your son. I came from Virginia to find you.
Off in the distance, a jay screeched, and another of his kind answered the call. Elizabeth leaned back in her chair and closed her eyes. When she opened them again, he was still sitting there in front of her. She half expected him to disappear, carried away by the same play of mind that summoned him in the first place.
My John, what trick is this?
No trick, madame. I'm sorry. I've had more time to get ready for this than you.
Elizabeth began to cry softly where she sat, her head in her big hands.
Praise be, she said finally. Come, help me up.
Yellow John pulled her up from the chair, slowly, a bit awkwardly, as if he were afraid to touch her. Elizabeth used her hands to try to find herself in his face, and then she folded him in her arms. They stayed that way until she let him go.
How could you find me all the way from Virginia?
It's a story that bears telling, madame, but first, could I bother you for a little more to eat? I haven't eaten for several days.
Elizabeth gave him the rest of the cornbread and fried 4 eggs in the skillet, turning back to look at the man sitting at her table. Yellow John was more controlled in his eating this time, rationing his bread and eggs carefully to make sure he didn't run out of one before the other, using the bread to sop up every bit of the runny yellow yolks. The plate he left behind looked as clean as if he had washed it.
Thank you kindly. He pushed himself back from the table.
Who told you about me?
Oh, Mas Robert. He didn't hide from Jacob or me that our mother's name was Elizabeth, and she'd been sold to a place called Cane River in Louisiana. He used us to get back at his wife, I think, never denying we had his blood, bringing us up to the big house under her nose, even teaching us to read a little.
Yellow John stole glances at Elizabeth as he talked, as if judging whether or not he was holding on to her attention.
I grew up and got me a wife from there on the place, and we tried to have children,
but we kept losing them before they were born. The third time, my wife made it through to the end, but the little one tried to come out feet first. They couldn't save mother or child. I lost them both on the same day. It doesn't seem I was meant to have children of my own.
Yellow John hesitated, as if he weren't sure what to say next.
Go on,
Elizabeth prodded, but she was careful not to spook him.
One day, I overheard young master talking about a slave they just bought sight unseen from some distant relation from Cane River, Louisiana. I made my way down to the quarters to see this new boy as soon as I could manage. He was a barrel-chested fella, quiet, had the slow look of someone fresh sold. He couldn't speak one word of English. He was young and still shy of coming into his full force, but he knew his way around hot metal and horses.
Clement? Elizabeth had trouble keeping up with so much news, so many twists and turns.
Yes, Clement. We went fishing together almost every Sunday, and we fashioned a language together while he taught me his French and I taught him my English. He had a quick mind, but it took some doing to draw him out. He was about the age my dead boy would have been had he lived, and I came to think on him as a son.
And Clement told you about us. It was more statement than question.
Yellow John nodded. It was slow going at first, but he understood more bit by bit. I was hungry for news of Cane River, and after a time, it became clear that his Elizabeth and my Elizabeth were the same.
His Elizabeth hadn't been born to French by the speaking of it, and she came to Louisiana from Virginia with a sad tale of children left behind and being sold to a family named Darbin.
Philomena had told him the story before he got sold old Master Robert. He described Cane River as the most beautiful place on earth. Virginia's pretty country, too, but his mind was on his old river home. He talked to you and of his own mother, Eliza, and your daughter, Suzette. But mostly he talked about Philomene and their two baby girls, Thaney and Bet. I've never seen a man so set on one woman. There's no shame in marrying again when you have to leave someone behind, especially so young, and there were plenty of girls ready on our place, but he never committed to just one.
Where is he? Where is Clement?
When a whisper talk of freedom started, we decided that on the very day of Jubilee, we would set out walking to Cane River together. Clement never got to put one foot on the path back here. He died after the men of the place went away to fight in the war.
Yellow John's voice became soft.
His was a stupid death, with no meaning at all in it. A water moccasin must have bitten him first. His leg was so swollen with poison, but he fell into the river and drowned. I decided to come on to Cane River by myself anyway. I know Clement would want me to tell Philomene that he didn't ever let go of her.
As she tended the blood-filled blisters on John's feet, Elizabeth didn't know whom to cry for first. Clement, who had died away from his home, so close to being able to come back to Philomene. Philomene, who had yet to hear about Clement and had already traded love for protection. Yellow John, whose torn body and bloody feet would heal, but who had spent an entire lifetime nursing an empty hole where his mother was supposed to be. Or herself, looking at this stranger calling himself her son, unable to replace the sweet little baby in her mind's eye, with the weary man in front of her now. Instead of the joy of reunion, she felt the theft of the past years that had taken so much from both of them. Her pain was mixed with anger at the waste. Her son was no longer a young man. She had missed it all. First steps, favorite food, selection of a wife. His dark curly hair was uneven and touched with gray, untended. She knew nothing about him other than the fact that he had craved her so much he had come all the way from Virginia to see her.
And Jacob? What happened to my Jacob? Jacob is a shoemaker in Richmond with a wife and 4 grown children. He was lucky. After we were free, he knew where all his children were.
The lids of Yellow John's eyes drooped almost shut for a moment, and he fought back a yawn.
We agreed if I couldn't find you, I'd go back to Virginia to live out my days with them. You've walked a long way and you need sleep. There's fresh hay in the barn, and I'll get a blanket. When you wake up, we can talk more. You're home now.
Elizabeth was tired, too, more than the usual dip at the tail of the afternoon. Seeing Yellow John had worn her out, and she was uncertain whether her dreams would be restful when she closed her eyes. She would tell Yellow John later about his half-sisters and half-brother, and about his great-niece Emily, 5 years old and down for her afternoon nap on Philomène's bed. There was too much to tell. He didn't know that Philomène was the strong one who planned the next step, that when a lifetime of being a slave made it hard to make decisions, Philomène did the thinking for all of them, and they let her, that the young guided the old. Elizabeth had a son who was healthy and could even read, and the Lord had led him back to her only through the bad business of Clement being sold. Sometimes good came out of hurt. Compensation came out of pain. He gave with one hand, and he took with the other. Her son was with her now, but it would fall to Elizabeth to tell Philomène that Clement was dead. It was almost dusk by the time Philomène and Jérôme came in together from the field. Elizabeth came outside and waved them aside before they could go into the barn to bed the mule. They left the animal outside and went into the house instead.
"There's someone sleeping in the barn," Elizabeth said. "Someone important to this family."
Her daughter's work dress was ringed with sweat stains, and a rag tied around a burst blister on one hand had dried stiff.
"Who is it, ma mère?"
Suspicion clouded Philomène's face, her body newly tensed as if ready to do battle, her tiredness pushed aside.
"My son, lost once but found again."
Elizabeth felt sapped of her energy, but she pushed herself forward.
"I had to leave him behind in Virginia."
"We have an uncle?"
It was as if Philomène had to play with the idea in her mind for a few minutes before she could accept Elizabeth's word as fact.
"Are you sure he's who he says he is?"
"A mother knows her child."
"How did he find us?"
Philomène was beginning to warm to the notion of an unknown family member presenting himself.
"Is he by himself? Weren't there 2 boys?"
"This one is Yellow John. Jacob has a family in Virginia."
"Has he come to stay?" Jérôme asked.
"My boy walked here all the way from Virginia. I hope so."
Elizabeth wanted to tell Philomène about Clement before Yellow John woke. She took Philomène's hand.
"Sit down, child. There is something to be said."
Philomène obeyed, growing solemn at Elizabeth's manner. Jérôme pulled up a chair, too, and sat next to his sister.
"Philomène, there's no way to say this but straight and fast. Yellow John is from the same place they sent Clement. Baby girl, Clement is dead."
It was as if Philomène hadn't heard.
"I'm not the same girl as when Clement left," she said.
Her back was stiff and her eyes dry.
"He'll be disappointed."
Elizabeth and Jérôme exchanged a quick glance in an attempt to make sense of Philomène's response. Elizabeth tried again.
"Clement has gone on beyond this world, to a better place. Do you understand what I'm telling you?"
Philomène just sat. Elizabeth thought she might scream or cry or fly apart, as she had when Clement was sold away, or retreat into silence. She tightened her grip on Philomène's hand, but it was limp inside her own.
"Was it by water?"
Philomène's tone was as flat as her eyes.
"Yellow John said Clement drowned, but he was planning to come back to you."
After a while, I couldn't feel him anymore. Philomène stood and walked toward the kitchen to dish up the supper Elizabeth had prepared. At least he never knew about Bed and Thaney and the yellow fever, Philomène said, as much to herself as anyone in the room. At least Clément never knew about Narcisse Frédieu.
Chapter 26. A neatly dressed, fresh-cheeked young man, the color of oatmeal, pulled up in a buggy alongside Suzette's cabin in the quarter and brought the horse to a halt. With the quickness of youth, he jumped down and was by her side, helping her up into the seat beside his.
"Good afternoon, Madame Jackson," he said.
"Good afternoon, Monsieur Verzin," she replied in her best voice, savoring the exchange.
Suzette had been ready since noon. After she'd fixed Saturday dinner for Augustine Frédieu's family, the rest of the week's end was her own. She had changed into her good dress, a shabby calico but freshly ironed, and carefully rewrapped a spotless bleached tignon around her head. Then she'd waited for Doralise's grandson to come for her, watching out for the buggy the way a child waits for a promised candy. But she was nervous, too. To be invited to Doralise's home with a gathering of gens de couleur libre, to ride in the front seat of a buggy like a grand lady all the way to Cloutierville, to be addressed with such respect by her new last name. Cane River was topsy-turvy. She had to keep reminding herself that the gens de couleur libre were no more. They were all free now, although Doralise's house was one of the few places former slaves mingled regularly with former Cane River colored royalty. Most of the gens de couleur libre refused to mix with any but their own, but Doralise pulled in a stream of visitors and went out of her way to make Suzette welcome, especially since Yellow John had come to Cane River. In the first few months after the war, little seemed to change for Suzette, but in important ways, everything changed. She worked hard as ever in Augustine Frédieu's kitchen, living in the same cabin she had shared for the last few years with another family. When Augustine Frédieu came back to his farm, he asked each of his former slaves left on the property to sign up to stay for a year. The contracts called for a small bit of money to change hands at the end of the season. Augustine explained that there wasn't much money to be had until the farm was built back up.
"My daughter wants me to move in to share crop with her on Richard Grant's plantation down near the lower part of Natchitoches Parish," Suzette told him. "And Madame Aureline has asked me to move to her farm, too."
Like the gens de couleur libre, Augustine wrapped himself in old habits, still expecting to be treated in the same way he had before the war. Suzette didn't care one way or the other, willing to do whatever would make things smooth.
"You and I don't need a paper, Monsieur Augustine," she said. "We can keep on like we always have until I finish my planning. I'm not ready to put my ex on anything yet."
"Madame Jackson." Suzette silently rolled the words over her tongue again. When for the first time they were allowed to create a last name for themselves, it was her mother Elizabeth, and not Suzette, who decided that the name would be Jackson. There was no hidden meaning to the choice, no long association with some significant event or person. Elizabeth merely said that she liked the clean sound of Jackson, that it didn't sound so French, the way everything along Cane River had her whole life. If she got to choose her own last name, she wanted it simple, a new beginning. For a time, Suzette tried to persuade Elizabeth to consider De Nègre, a last name she had invented as far back as Rosedew, but her arguments were of no use.
"My name is Jackson," Elizabeth had said. "I hope you see your way to carry the same name."
Suzette wanted a tie, a thread between her mother and herself that everyone could see, so she became Suzette Jackson, finally one of the ones with last names. Suzette took pleasure in the taste of freedom, wanted to savor it without committing to anyone, at least for a while. Philomène had managed to collect 11 of the family close together in bordering sharecropper cabins. Philomène, little Emily, and Philomène's youngest, Eugène, born right after Easter. Elizabeth and Yellow John, and Jérôme Elantine and their children.
It comforted Suzette to know they were all so close, but as powerful as the temptation to drift back into the comfort of family was, Suzette hesitated, at a crossroads. Stay on Augustine Frédieu's farm, go to her daughter, or go to Aureline. There was something so delicious about having choices that she found she couldn't let go just yet. Suzette preferred to remain where she was, making plans, weighing her options, humming her way through work that demanded more of her hands than her mind. Madame Jackson. By the time they reached Cloutierville, Suzette's excitement had turned to quiet reflection. By the time they came to Doralise's house, it had turned to dread. Her godmother's house was plain, not unlike the other houses in the town, but well kept up. Clumps of jasmine were planted beside the front steps leading up to the gallery, and bright scarlet tufts of early blue azaleas poked up from window boxes on either side of the front door. Suzette and her young escort entered Doralise's front room. 6 or 8 people were there already, some seated, some standing, talking among themselves. It was a blur to Suzette, but she immediately noted everyone in the room had lighter skin than she. The darkest before she walked into the room was the color of honey. "Suzette!" Doralise called to her, waving her over to where she sat in her favorite chair, an overstuffed plush green. She was flanked on one side by a man of middle age, and on the other by Yellow John. Since Yellow John had come to Cane River, he and Doralise had become as comfortable with each other as a pair of old slippers. The sight of her half-brother gave Suzette more confidence, and he greeted her warmly, but she knew she wasn't the match of the people in this room. They had lived a different life, had a different future in store. The only one she saw who didn't carry the shame of slavery was Yellow John, and even he could read. Then she recognized him, the man sitting calmly on Doralise's other side. He was older, more heavy-set than she recalled, his short-cut graying hair receded and thinning at the top of his head, but he had the same sleepy-eyed kindness to his face. Nicolas Moulon. She still owned the old strip of cowhide he had given her when she was a girl. It was a miserable, shapeless piece now, worn beyond any possible use. The stubborn stiffness of the scrap reassured her each time she rubbed it for luck. He had been staring at her, she realized, since she'd walked into the room. Suzette knew how much she had changed and chafed at how disappointed he must be to see her here. She wanted to turn tail and run, spare them both the embarrassment.
"Suzette, you're here at last," Doralise said. "Monsieur Moulon has asked about you often. I thought to invite you both so you could become reacquainted."
The room grew small for Suzette, devoid of air, until Nicolas Moulon gave Suzette the shy smile she remembered from so long ago. Sunday was reserved for church and Philomène's farm.
"I don't understand why you won't move in with us, Maman."
The supper dishes were cleared away, and Suzette, Philomène, and Elizabeth sat talking on the front porch, which was cooler than indoors. Gérard and Mélantine had gone for a walk, and the children were off getting into their own mischief. Suzette came to Philomène's house, as she did every week, continuing to resist the invitations to move in, nursing her joyous secret. Surrounded by most of the people she loved best in the world, she smiled to herself. One was noticeably absent, she thought.
"It is comfortable enough where I am for now," Suzette told Philomène. "I'll decide where to go when I finish my planning." "I'm going to pull us all back together again," Philomène said. "On our own land. I don't know how long it will take, but we can work our own place better than we can someone else's."
"How are you going to get your own land?" Suzette asked. "There's no money. Everyone around here is scratching just to get from one day to the next. Be grateful for what you have."
"Sharecropping is slavery with a different name.
Philomène looked combative. Even when money changes hands, it goes back to settle debts. Not even Madame Aureline has land anymore, Suzette said. We're family, and we'll find a way to take care of our own. What Madame has or doesn't have isn't our worry. We can all take in washing, ironing, and sewing while we sharecrop. We can save. I'll put myself behind a plow again if it means that girl over there will never have to, Philomène said, nodding in Emily's direction. Little Emily sat cross-legged on the far side of the porch, absorbed, dangling a twisting slip of green ribbon between her small, thin fingers in front of a tomcat that batted at the moving target with his paw. "Keep her out of the sun," Suzette scolded. "You know what it will do to her skin. That's her future. She's meant for better." Philomène nodded in agreement and kept at her mending. "We can grow most of our food, fish and trap the rest. We'll make out." "I have a different plan for what comes next." Suzette sat back in her chair, enjoying the look of bewilderment that crossed Philomène's face. "What plan is that, Maman?" Suzette sported a slow grin, the gap between her front teeth prominent. "I have a gentleman who wants to marry me. In the church. A real marriage they put down in a book, not one of those slavery things." Philomène's face seemed to go slack for a moment, and Suzette's smile withered as she realized what she had said. "I'm so sorry, Philomène. You had as real a marriage as there could be. This old woman has gotten foolish and hurtful. That's what happens when God hands you a gift long after you stop hoping." Philomène gave Suzette a careful appraising look, the same long look Suzette had given her own mother after Yellow John had arrived in Cane River, and she'd realized Elizabeth had a life she knew nothing about. "Maman, what gift?" The timid smile crept back into Suzette's voice. "Before you were born, a boy lived next door to us on Rosedew." She turned to Elizabeth. "You remember him, Mère? Nicolas Moulon. Now he's a colored shoemaker set up in Cloutierville. We were confirmed at the same time and took First Communion together." Elizabeth nodded. Suzette turned back to Philomène. "When I was a girl, I wished so hard that Nicolas and I would grow up and get married that sometimes I actually thought it was true. It was not possible then. He was Jean de couleur libre. Later, Nicolas married a free woman of color, just the way Mère always said he would."
"Go on, Mama," Philomène said.
"The war brought some down and raised others up. Most of the Jean de couleur libre still played being grand after losing everything, because they were free before the rest of us. Marraine d'Orhalis was never like that, or Nicolas. I saw him again for the first time in over 20 years when I visited d'Orhalis. His wife died this year, leaving him with 3 children to take care of, one still in breechcloth. Nicolas remembered me." Suzette turned shy, all at once hot, using her embroidery hoop as a fan. "And I remembered him. He has a little piece of land near Cloutierville, and we've been talking about me living with him on it, becoming stepmother to those children." "I never thought of you living with a man, Mama," Philomène said. She paused, carefully unwrapping the unexpected turn of events, examining each fold. "Do you love him?" "I never had a man for more than an hour at a time, all my days on this earth," Suzette said. "I wouldn't mind somebody to make a life with, without what you call love. But yes, I love Nicolas. I want to be with him, and do for him, and I want him to do for me. I knew the first evening over at Madame d'Orhalis's, and so did he. Like time skipped back, and we got a second try." Philomène didn't hide her puzzlement. Her thick eyebrows knotted in concentration, her lips pressed almost to a grimace.
Did you love my papa at all?
Suzette shifted uncomfortably. The mood had turned strained with too much talk. Three generations of women out on the front porch, four counting little Emily, trying to put words around a past and a future that could never be explained. But the rawness in Philomène's face persuaded Suzette to make the attempt.
No. There were no parts of love there, except you and Jérôme that came out of it. That was a different time.
Philomène, I saw how you were with Clément. That was young love.
Mère, you and Gérassime, that was love too. Jérôme and Mélantine, still more love. I've been surrounded by it, but never thought I'd get a taste myself. Eugène Dorade and me, there was no choice. Love is pull. That was all push.
The light outside was beginning to fail. They would need to call the children in soon.
So you're going to marry Nicolas Moulin? Elizabeth asked.
As soon as we get enough money saved, Suzette answered.
Others have the same idea. Folks already living as man and wife can make it proper now. Doralise and Yellow John will marry when we do, and we thought we would share a party together after. Jérôme and Mélantine may want to consider coming forward, too.
Suzette sat back in her chair, enjoying the surprise around her. There was nothing more satisfying than having plans. Chapter 27. Even with both the front and back doors open to encourage a breeze, the air barely stirred at all in the sweltering heat of Philomène's four-room cabin. She turned the heavy pressing iron on end to cool, brushing the sweat from her eyes with the back of her sleeve. It wouldn't do to scorch the starched, delicate lacework she needed to deliver to Widow Grenot by afternoon. Fancy ironing generated more money than flat work and required full attention. With two children and a grandmother depending on her, and 2 years of freedom gone, Philomène had learned to navigate the world of money paid for service. She glanced outside to check on the children.
"Emilie Frédieu, how many times do I have to tell you not to let the sun get to your skin?" she called through the window. "March yourself and your brother inside. That sun will make you common."
"Aunt Mélantine lets Cousin Alice and Cousin Adolphe play in the sun," Emily said.
"I know I don't hear sass in your voice," Philomène said.
At 6, Emily was old enough to know the consequences of talking back.
"Non, maman."
The girl brushed dust from her shiny black shoes with one hand and took Eugène by the other to lead him into the house.
"You're meant for better, Emily Frédieu. Just stay where I can see you."
"Yes, maman."
"Your papa comes this afternoon to carry you visiting. Take Eugène Frédieu to ma mère to clean him up."
"Bring the baby to me, Emily."
Elizabeth took off the girl's bonnet and hung it on the peg by the front door, and had Eugène lift up his arms to slip off his soiled undershirt.
"You're as color-struck as Suzette," she said to Philomène.
"Fair skin will give them advantage," Philomène said.
She looked at her children. Their sandy brown hair was straight, and all their features were French, not African.
"Either could pass."
Elizabeth grunted.
"That kind of thinking breaks up families."
Philomène knew she would be an immediate giveaway if she ever tried to lead her children into that kind of life. The olive in her skin darkened with the slightest exposure to the sun.
"Emily and Eugène do fine right here," Elizabeth went on. "Even Monsieur Narcisse doesn't fuss when you call them Frédieu to his face."
"Emily Frédieu and Eugène Frédieu will have choices," Philomène said to her grandmother, carefully folding the frilled collar piece, still warm, and adding it to the pile.
The evening cooled down almost enough to be pleasant, with an occasional short-lived breeze. Philomène and Narcisse stayed out on the porch of the cabin after everyone else had gone to bed. Smoke curled around the tip of Narcisse's fat cigar, and Philomène embroidered by the unsteady light of the oil lamp.
"Is that from the general store?"
Narcisse used the cigar's smoldering tip to point to the cloth in Philomène's lap. Philomène held up the small blue garment for Narcisse to admire.
"A new visiting dress for Emilie Frédieu," she said. "On last month's bill, you spent almost as much on material and sundries as flour, sugar, salt, and seed combined."
"They need proper clothes."
"I have never scrimped with either Emilie or Eugène,"
Narcisse said, taking offense.
"The girl does not need another new dress. They remarked on it today at Augustine's. Emilie has more dresses than his girls, twice her age. You spoil her overmuch."
"You spoil her as well, Monsieur Narcisse."
"I mean it, Philomène. No more. Don't make me close off the account to you."
They sat on the porch, sewing and smoking in silence.
"I have seen your future," Philomène said after a time.
Narcisse got up and moved his chair to face Philomène, slowly, as if he were an ox being led to field, pacing himself for the full day's work ahead.